life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
He kōna I purangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
All right, welcome back into the caucus room. You're most welcome to join us. Nau mai, haere mai, kia ora, and let's start with the roll call. I'm Tim Watkin.
I'm Guyan Espiner.
Lisa Owen.
I'm not Scott Campbell still, I'm Julian Wilcox.
That's very good to have you here. Well, we're all clear and present. So, a busy campaign this week. The first leaders' debate was one of those key things. We're going to get to that shortly. But let's just look at the state of the race first. We talked about a lot about the right block last week on the where the polls were at. Let's talk a little bit about new poll this week, because One News, Verizon are polling every week now, very similar to the previous ones. But we can look a little bit at the left block in particular. But look, what do you make of this poll? And what does it tell us about the state of the race now?
I don't want to look at the left block. I want to look at the right block, and here's why.
As
downward
always,
spiral.
You start,
sorry,
you start
I'll be contrary.
One way, and then suddenly Lisa's
yeah.
off.
You know, duck and weave. Because what I saw in that, the most interesting thing for me was the drop off in national support. Yeah. Right, 2 points down.
Yep.
Labour is discussed, and I feel that someone in this caucus has used the words death spiral, not looking at anyone in particular. But so, didn't surprise me, Labour's numbers. It lines up with other polls and right. down 1% from the last time. The thing with National is you're starting to get into the territory where they just have a one-seat majority with ACT, right?
Yep.
One skinny little seat.
But they're 2% down is ACT 2% up, right? So nothing yes. changed on the right block.
No, nothing
changed on
nothing
the right
changes,
block.
Nothing changes, but that's why while there is a direct transfer of votes, and you don't know that that's going to hold up. So
no.
National's down 2, ACT is up 2, right, as you say. But at 61 seats, you've got a tight squeak there into government, mm-hmm. which brings us to Mr. Winston Peters. And already the narrative, I think, has changed from Christopher Luxon. I've heard him saying already, I will work with what the New Zealand public give me on election night. And for me, that is a subtle shift from, I ain't talking about that, it's hypothetical, I don't want to talk about Winston Peters, I don't want to talk about New Zealand First.
Yeah, this poll blows out of the water his line that Peters isn't registering above the threshold. I mean, we've had a number of polls which show he is. This poll is a very credible one. They've been running it under different names for a long time. And to see Peters a couple of weeks out at 5% in this poll really confirms that he most likely will be back in Parliament. This is close to a nightmare scenario for Christopher Luxon. He could well be, you know, incoming Prime Minister, but if ACT National, even at that level, it's not enough, is it? Mm. I mean, mathematically, 61, 62 might be enough, but it's always a scandal in a Parliament. You can lose a by-election. You don't want to be at 61, lose a by-election 18 months in and have to go to the country again. It's simply not enough of a buffer.
So you would assume that you would have to say Winston, give Winston a call as well.
Yep, I've been talking
on
this podcast.
You can't go fishing, Winston, you've got to actually come and talk to me.
I've been talking about on this podcast before that I think he should be making at least back-channel communications with the Pāti Māori and the Green Party about potential more nuanced combinations of abstaining or whatever. Mm. But yes, he would have to go to Winston Peters.
They don't want to have that call.
Well, they may not. I do remind people that Key had a memorandum of understanding with the Green Party in one of his terms as Prime Minister. These things are. Did people expect that of the Pāti Māori in 08? I know it's a different party, and I won't go into that too much. The most obvious call is to Winston Peters, but it is a potential nightmare scenario.
It's a call he won't be looking forward to making. I'm trying to listen to the principal who's trying to guide us to the left, but the only thing I wanted to add it about the right-leaning parties was I made a call to a couple of people I know in National. The words "we've peaked" came, and there's a bit of concern about that because they're worried about about more vote actually going to New Zealand First, not to ACT. They're worried about losing a bit of vote to New Zealand First. And then you have a look at some of those
Coalition
other...
Coalition of chaos!
And then you have a look at some of those other very minor parties. I mean, the Liz Gunn party at 1%, where did that come from? New Zealand Loyal, I think the name is. She doesn't even have registered candidates.
No, registered.
And then Vision New Zealand.
She's just got billboards.
Vision New Zealand at 1%. So, you know, if you're one of those voters, Liz Gunn's party voters will probably go, oh, hell, we have to go with Winston now. Vision New Zealand will probably stay. But that's another 1% assured, right? That's 6. He does a really good campaign. Normally, he gets another bump of 1.5, you said last week, gone. He's at 7.5. That's 9 seats. It includes Andy Forster in them. That's a big chunk of seats.
That is a big chunk.
But to come to the left, and this
thank
is what
you for
asked.
The thank you for that. Yeah, no, that
I'll
is
do
good,
what I'm told.
That is good state of play stuff. Let me take it back to the left, because the reason why I wanted to talk about that was when you look at Labour now on 27-28% for a number of polls, it's actually quite revealing when you actually punch those numbers into the Electoral Commission calculator, and Lisa has walked me through this with her very accurate numbers that she likes to point out to me that they are very precise and wonderful numbers.
Only because, I suppose the message in that was...
There's no fiscal hole in this.
There's no fiscal in these numbers.
She's showing us her workings.
I think the point...
Release your modelling, Owen.
Yeah, I'm happy to release my modelling. I think the point is here, Tim, I would take from our conversation is when I gave Tim these numbers, he went, what? Are you sure you're right?
Because I'm surprised.
Yes, and that is the whole point. All right. Was surprised.
Let's bring the listeners into this conversation about why I was surprised, because the point is quite how thin Labour's list MPs become. The assumption being that Labour holds on to maybe around 30 electorate seats because they have some pretty, you know, deep roots into electorate
seats. From 45 at the moment.
So we're saying, you talk about the 12 to 15 red wave seats that we kind of give those away. There's a few other seats that maybe go right because of a kind of a blue wave coming through this time. So we've punched in around 30 electorate seats for Labour. You then get, if New Zealand First is in as well, you're getting down to only four list MPs for Labour. And they are Grant Robertson, Aisha Verrill, probably Jantonetti because she loses Tauranga. And who's the fourth?
Willie Jackson. Yeah.
You lose Andrew Little. You lose David Parker. You lose potentially Labour's next cabinet of younger up-and-coming people, Kieran McInulty, Willow Jean Prime. You know, this is...
With the rider, if they lose their
electorate. Because these are all in tight electorate races.
Yes,
these
they are. All. Indeed,
so
they are.
Labour, potentially, on these kind of numbers, gets that new generation gutted.
That's right, and that will be a big concern to them. And you've already seen what happens when you get this risk of not enough lifeboats as the Titanic's going down. And you saw Greg O'Connor do this at a meeting, at an election meeting in Wellington, where he effectively conceded his party was going to lose, that Nicola Willis was going to be the finance minister, and that people should vote for him on the electorate, and didn't really seem to matter what they did with the party vote.
He said, let's face it, unless something changes in the debate tonight, which is the day of the first leaders debate, Nicola's likely to be the next finance minister.
That is a disaster for a party, because their focus should always be on the party vote, getting out the party vote. And once you start to see it splinter off and people looking after their own skins, you run into real trouble. And that's what sees you slump to a sort of tied out sort of 25% sort of number.
And the thing we should point out about Greg O'Connor in Ohariu is he is not on the party list. So he has one shot at survival. And we can, I'm just looking to the principal now, we're probably talking about some of those seats a bit later.
No.
So I won't go there.
I talked to a Labour MP this week and who said, we think 27, we can pick up from there. The turnout's going to be key. The turnout will get our percentage up. But at least no one in the electorate is putting the electorate first yet. We're still on message. And then literally the next day, Greg O'Connor does this.
The other thing I noticed, and this came out of the Māori Television poll on Tuesday in Te Tai Hamaoru, Soraya Peke Mason, who I think many people thought wouldn't win against Debbie Ngārua Packer, is ahead by 5. Now there's a margin of error of 4.5. It's still a tight race. The ironic thing about that is if she makes it via the electorate, the one who loses out is Adrian Dudafe.
Yeah.
Who's the current speaker, who was, of course, the MP for that electorate, who stood down from that electorate. So that's an interesting thing. And I think also the interesting thing for me is there are people that potentially haven't been considered, like Kusha Tangaire, for example, in Eko Rorafiti. Many thought Mekara Faitiri would carry that and Labour wouldn't win it. The indicators are it's a really tight race. In actual fact, really the favouritism could be with Kusha Tangaire. So that may have an effect as well. You're absolutely right on turnout. Labour turnout normally means Labour doesn't do well in an election.
No.
In 2020, one of the lowest polling, lowest turnouts of an electorate was Tāmaki Makaurau. Now, that was Penny Henry and JT. The expected turnout this year in a Māori electorate, they think, is going to be lower. Now, if you're already at 65%, what are we talking about? Really? Below 60, right? Jeez. We could end up, in Māori electorates anyway, with a very low turnout.
Why the lack of engagement?
Well, a couple of things. One is that there's a the disinformation, misinformation campaigns around politics has really affected turnout. We've seen that in local body elections and we're seeing that in this one. Particularly in Māori electorates, when you start hearing parties talk about Māori and the way that Māori get politicised as the football, particularly in this one, it turns voters off and people don't get enough of the aspiration they want to hear to get out and vote. Give them something to get out and vote for. It was interesting in the debates that we did for the Hui, the Māori electorate debates. The Labour messaging has switched. It went from the big, bad, dark, evil right, right-leaning parties, and that's still there. It's now gone to we need you to get out and vote.
Yeah.
Because they're very worried about
voter
turnout.
The same thing.
But it also seems to me, talking to some of my National Party mates, that they're worried about low voter turnout as well, because some of theirs might not come out. Whereas
they think, oh, Luxon's got it.
Because I think Luxon's got it.
And also people are disillusioned. Go back to caucus, episode one.
Yes.
people are disillusioned.
Well, you look at this. This is the point, right, again, with these the polls consistently showing 37% for National, around that, 27% for Labour. You are talking about some of the lowest combined votes for the two major parties, right?
So well, absolutely. I mean, you'd have to go back. In 1999, Helen Clark got 39% of the vote and took over as the new Prime Minister at the end of that millennium, and never actually breached 40, over 40%. So she ran three minority governments. But I cannot think of a leading party in government who've got there on that number, on 37. And National really needs to drift into the late 30s, early 40s, if they are going to be a credible major force.
96, National got 34 with New Zealand First on 13. So they were that very, very first MMP election where there was that, the minor parties.
How long did that last?
Not
18 months.
Because
in August 98, the whole thing blew up hard. And that is the problem.
Yeah.
When you are not strong enough in your coalition, if you think about it as a cocktail, if you're only two-thirds of the drink.
You don't want to be watered down.
No, I think the other thing, we talked about the potential loss of leadership for Labour, right? 12% for the Green Party, that gets them down to maybe 14 or 15 MPs. And by the way, there's another ex-Wellington mayor at 15 on the Green Party list, Celia Wade-Brown. So not only do you get a former mayor in Andy Forster, you get Celia Wade-Brown as well. But you have a look at the Green Party on that list. If they get 12%, Huhana Linden, strong, Taitokero, Fesil Collins, strong, stood for the Auckland mayoralty. Darlene Tanner, Tāmaki Makaurau, Kohanan Carter in Central, Christchurch Central. The new left leadership could actually be in the Green Party, not in Labour, if they stay at 27%.
Well, you love a history lesson, so shall we go back to 2014?
Please.
Take you there. You will remember this. David Cunliffe.
Yes.
Hard to forget. So if you look at the figures that Labour returned in that election, that was, when you look at the official count on the Election Commission website, Labour 25.1% of the votes. And when I saw David Cunliffe doing post-leaders debate analysis, I sort of thought to myself, wow, he'd be sitting there hoping that someone takes the crown from him, maybe.
The worst ever Labour leader.
Did he apologise for that result?
Just for being a man.
He apologised for a couple of things.
But I don't... So look, guys, you might disagree with me on this one, but this is the thing that strikes me, is that I do remember 2014, and I remember the disarray that Labour was in at the time, right? Mm. They were all over the place. And usually that's the kind of numbers you see when a party is imploding, or when a party is making huge swinging cuts through the economy, or something dramatic is going on. This doesn't feel to me like a sub-30 result for Labour now, right?
Really?
The economy... Yeah.
Why?
Because the economy is not a basket case. It is below average, but it's picking up. Inflation's
coming down. But you talked about a party imploding, right? You talked about a party imploding. Is you've only seen low figures when you've seen a party imploding. They lit their own bonfire and they threw some kerosene on it and got rid of and got rid of a bunch of policies that say we are Labour.
Right.
They smoked their own identity.
Yeah, and remember that they did lose, was it 4 or 5 ministers? I mean, and you're thinking back to that now.
In a quick fire.
And so that's where people are. Are stuck, right?
And yeah, and also they have been a little unlucky in some ways on the economy in that we find out as we record this at about midday on Thursday that Stats New Zealand are saying we probably weren't in recession for that time. And look, this is technical jargon, really. Two quarters of negative growth equals recession, and they then revised the figures.
Yeah.
But it has allowed National to accurately say New Zealand is the only country in the region who's in recession, and that's been damaging. And actually rebounded a little quicker than a little higher than what people thought. So they have been unlucky.
And also, it's about feels. If people feel they can't take the block of cheese out of the cooler at the supermarket, they don't give a flying, you know what, about whether you're in technical recession or not. Yeah. They care about whether they can have one piece of broccoli or none, and whether they can have some cheese, and if it's okay to get, you know, not the 99-cent bread. And it's about those feels.
It is about those feels, and crime and law and order. I don't want to divert us too off track, but, you know, when you're getting people murdered at bus stops and things, which is just now not even half a day's on the news.
You've stolen
cycle.
My line from the debate, Lisa. Thank you very much. Because I was going to say they haven't caught people in the fields. And the other thing that if you talk to young people, the phrase they use now is they're not popping off.
Yeah.
And no one's popping off. And when you don't have that, then voter turnout goes down. And
popping
voters
off
don't
in
get
terms
it.
Of, explain that to an old fella.
I'm trying to get, you know, youth aligned here.
Because
I'm certainly not rangatahi. But anyway, but one of the
adjacent.
Other...
You,
it's a phrase I like to use, and I've been told don't because it's not true now. But the other thing I was going to say was that normally when Labour's like this, the party that would grow a lot is the Māori Party. Hasn't happened.
No.
And it's not happening. They're 3%, so that means they will get Hunter Rāwhiti, Maipi Clarkin, 21 years old now, which would be great for that party. I do worry about her going into Parliament, to be honest, when you're 21. But anyway, she's a niece of mine and I know her mother. But that's great for the party. But at 3% and only at the moment winning one electorate, which is Wairakei, normally they would be able to transfer that into 7 electorates.
Why aren't they?
Because it looks like that in the Māori electorates, despite what's happened, despite not playing to what you talked about earlier, Lisa, about really using the mandate that they had to do big, bold, brass board policy that would appeal to their base, Māori are still sticking to the tried and true. They still trust people like Kelvin Davis and I, and Mahuta definitely, Pēni Hendore in the Hui debate last night.
So big mana wins.
It looks that way. Yeah. Te Tikatene is still going to win to Taitunga, you know, and that's what it looks like, which is interesting.
While we're talking about some of these electorate seats, I just wanted to play this clip about the Wellington Central race, because this is fascinating in terms of what we're talking about, the swing and the swing that we see in both the electorates and in the parties being interlinked.
Labour's vote has plummeted by more than 15 points. It is now level pegging with National, which has jumped 13 points, and just behind are the Greens on 26.5%. And that super tight race for the party vote is mirrored when it comes to the candidates. Labour's Ibrahim Omair is out in front on 30.6%, but National's Scott Sheeran is right behind him on 28, and the Greens' Tamitha Paul, she is on 26.6%.
So News Hub Nation polling Wellington Central there. And you can see, I mean, that's Grant Robertson's seat. I mean,
and
I know,
again, you did not believe me when I told you.
I did not. But the fact that is split across, you can see a National candidate, what did they say, 13% up? Mm. I mean, that tells you something about the mood we're talking
about.
Well,
there was some interesting analysis earlier on in the campaign that there was some evidence that younger voters were trending more to the right this time, which is very unusual, right?
I mean,
you know, usually seats like that where the Greens have done very well in the past.
They have. And ACT held it. I mean, to be fair, Wellington Central's volatile, right?
But and Preble famously won it in 96. So it has switched around a bit.
But yeah, interesting to see that some younger people are opting for the right aisle of politics.
One of the central was always my smoky, and my smoky is I think Timothy Paul's going to win the seat.
Yeah,
and I said that I said that when she announced she's a very popular candidate. Yeah. In Wellington, the stuff she's done with council, her policies appeal to a lot of people in Wellington. I thought if she put her hand up, she'd be in the race. That's my smoky.
Yeah, and I mean, there's a lot of public servants in Wellington. I don't know that they will be voting for the, for the sword.
For the slash. Yeah.
From the ACT Party.
That's right. All right, look, let's, we've talked about the Hariu and how close that is. You made the point off mic earlier that, Greg O'Connor's not just running for his life there, but there's that point that he's trying to paint Nicola Willis as she's going to be too busy, right? She's going to be too busy for a seat that is a Hariu famously all about its local MP, right? So that's...
Yeah, I remember, I think it was you as a producer on Q&A, it might have been The Nation, trying to get Peter Dunn on the shows at the weekend, political shows. Couldn't get him on. Because
you could never get Peter Dunn to leave a Hariu on the weekend.
No, because he knew where his bread was buttered.
Absolutely.
He was a hard-working electorate MP and he'd do those clinics on the weekends.
So you could get him on the line if you were lucky, but boy, you could never get him out of there. No, even in the midst of all the drug reforms and everything. Nope, staying in a hurry.
And that is how Greg O'Connor is selling it, because when Parliament rose, his job was Deputy Speaker, right?
Yeah.
And electorate MP. That's it.
Yeah.
And that is what he is selling to the people, that he's done the yards. And as you mentioned, Peter Dunn, I think that electorate liked having an MP that concentrated on them and what they needed. Mm. There is a kind of, I don't know, badge to having a leader or a deputy leader or a prime minister or deputy prime minister in your electorate. So it's, how much will they be swayed by that? But again, Ohariu, you know, the bureaucrats who are going to be sliced and diced under various right-wing policies, they live there too.
They do.
Yeah.
They do. I was going to mention, and talking about leaders, you know, electorates who like leaders, I'll just mention Tamaki very quickly before we move on to the debate. Because there's this interesting clip from Brooke van der Velden, who's running for ACT there, who is reckons that it's neck and neck.
What's your polling saying?
We don't do polling.
Okay. Brooke, do you?
Yeah, look, we did a poll about a month and a half ago now, and it said that myself and O'Connor are neck and neck. And I think since then the momentum has continued to build.
That's a really interesting race. That's my electorate, and that used to be Robert Muldoon's electorate, and so, you know, used to love having the leader of the country there. But I've heard a number of national voters say to me that Brooke is pretty impressive. And honestly, her billboards, that pink coat, is flipping everywhere in Tamaki. So,
and she's been doing a lot of those street corner meetings. And
so is O'Connor, to be fair.
Yes,
I've seen them and feed
on the ground. And we're talking about Simon O'Connor here, who has had some very vocal and conservative policy positions, which might not sit well, in particular, with women voters.
Yeah. He's one of those guys who, again, have a very connected local MP, though, so it'll be interesting. It's
he was the one who made that veiled reference to Roe versus Wade, wasn't he?
Not very veiled.
It's
a great day to be alive.
That's right.
Yeah. So you know, and then she is presenting as a younger woman on the right.
Yeah.
And
economics degree.
Yes. Yeah. And potentially has that appeal of what has loosely been referred to as those swing voters, John Keys, women voters of a certain age, you know, may find her very appealing. And she's got a high profile now.
I've seen her in a couple of public settings. She's impressive. Yeah. Gregarious, ingratiates really well to an audience, speaks well. Apparently there's that band at Parliament. She sometimes, you know, steals the mic off Mikey Sherman and leads a couple of the songs, you know. She's popular. And when you listen to her, you know, some of her Māori issues need a bit of refining in my view, but she presents really well. I can see why she'd be a popular candidate.
And it's interesting that it rammed home that point about the two parties on the right having deputy women leaders who are actively profiling, right, to try and soften their
their image, if you like, which is a terrible gender stereotype, but you know what I mean, right? That that's what they're doing.
Yes, I said screw my face.
I know. I'm not saying it's a good thing, but I'm saying it's happening.
The other thing we should say about Brooke is that she was material in the euthanasia campaign. So she was working behind the scenes on the legislation, working with David Seymour before she became the deputy leader. And I would suggest to you in Tāmaki that that is a big issue for a lot of people.
For a lot of old people in Tāmaki. No. Leave it there. The debate, the first leaders' debate happened this week.
Is this related to euthanasia?
Well played, sir, well played. You felt that, let's develop that. You felt that they did kind of shot themselves in the...
Well, it was leaders. A bit of a charisma-free zone, wasn't it? I mean, I felt that Luxon would have been happiest with that. I mean, Labour's and the left's sort of hope was that somehow he would implode and that his unfitness to take office and his inexperience would be exposed by Chris Hipkins, who was the more experienced political operator. That simply didn't happen.
No.
I mean, roughly people scored it marginally in favour of Luxon. I probably would have been there too, but it roughly was a draw, wasn't it? Which is fine if you're either leader, except that Hipkins is so well behind that he needed a big circuit breaker, and that just didn't happen.
Debate of missed opportunities, you think?
Yeah. I saw a lot of comment about people wanted Hipkins to go out and be strong and be really robust and argumentative and hit him at every chance, and it just didn't pan out that way.
But the public don't always love it. The public don't love that, actually.
Yeah, and that's the point, right? And he's the Prime Minister. You kind of want to be Prime Ministerial. You don't want to be the one that's kind of agitating, because then you look like you're the leader of the opposition. There were a couple of clangers from both of them, actually, that I know we'll talk about a bit later. But in terms of tone, if you have a look at the body language of the two of them. There was a distinct difference. And if you turn the sound off and watch, half of that debate, you would almost think Luxon was the Prime Minister, because he was very controlled. He has this kind of poise that he just sits in his space, very kind of natural pose, and projects fairly well. And Hipkins did too. But I think if you were just going to do it purely on who won that debate, you'd probably say that Luxon shaded him just a bit. But it was a different kind of debate, I think, from the one that we expected in the way in which it came out. And I think that's why a lot of people felt a little bit low about it.
Lisa, can we, before we go into your points of this, can we just play this clip of a bunch of the quick fires? Because I think this tells you something really significant.
Chris Hipkins, first of all, have you ever had a speeding ticket?
Yes. Yes.
Is now the time for New Zealand to become a republic?
No.
No.
Should we continue to ban nuclear-powered ships from our waters?
Yes. Yes.
Should cannabis be decriminalised?
No.
No.
Should vapes be prescription only?
No.
No, not at this stage.
Personally, would you be happy to pay wealth tax?
No, I think it would be a wrecking ball through the economy.
I don't think a wealth tax is the way to go.
Should transgender people be allowed to compete in sport?
That's a decision for the sporting bodies.
Decision for the sporting bodies.
Tax for vacant houses, yes or no?
No.
No.
And how old were you when you bought your first home?
24.
Yeah, it would have been about the same.
I mean, we let that run, but oh my God.
Which was which?
Could they be more similar?
I mean, I have to say, I was pretty underwhelmed by the performance of both of those leaders. And that shows what we've been talking about. We're talking about a head-on collision at the centre line. Right, that illustrated that. So I know some people criticise quick-fire questions, but I think you get a taste of certain things, and then later you can capitalise on the little nuggets you might get from that. But when they talked about their houses, right, at one point they were asked about, when they bought their first houses, mm-hmm. and they later clarified exact dates, and I think one was 22 and one was 23 years old. Wow, I mean, what hope do you hold for 22 and 23-year-olds now? What age do you think people will be when they afford their first home? Nice for you, but what about,
So it's 43-year-olds who on decent incomes who can't afford a house.
If you're lucky.
How much is your house compared to your income then as opposed to now, right? Yes. I mean, these are the policy questions that come off it.
As a calculation, what's the ideal? I think it's like four times or something.
Yeah, three or four.
Would have been around there then, and now it's what, 19?
Yeah, exactly. So there were things there, but I felt that both of them tended to just skim the surface. You got a lot of slogans repeated. And I felt that Chris Hipkins was on the defensive from the get-go. And by that, I don't mean nasty, aggro or anything like that. But he was defending his party's position rather than selling his wares. He spent a lot of time defending his party's position.
Which marks out his whole performance and the handover from Ardern to Hipkins, which was smooth and praised at the time for the way that it provided a smooth transition of leadership. But he's been good at being the anti-Ardern candidate, but really taken a sort of a national light road since then and failed to really articulate and forge out a Labour position since then. And I think you saw that in the debate too. He's failed to actually capture what it is that Labour stands for and to be bold and to capture imaginations. He's been a lot better at hosing down the three waters or the co-governance or the merger at TVNZ and ANZ. All those things they chucked on the bonfire but never really forged a new path.
You could flip
what
side...
What do you build from the ashes, right?
Yeah, you could flip side that for National as well and say, of that list of questions that you were both asked there and you both have answered virtually exactly the same to every question. What differentiates the National Party from Labour? So you've got Labour, who is Labour-lite, and then some people would argue you've got National, who's Labour-lite, who hasn't gone far enough with their policies to satisfy people who want significant and real change, which is what... without being a mouthpiece for David Seymour, that is what he would argue, right? So if you're presenting as same, where is the point of difference for people? And I sort of thought slightly disingenuous from a number of commentators who sort of said, well, what you saw there, if you were an undecided voter, would not change your mind. Give people some credit. Not everybody is choosing between those two people.
That's right.
And also, that might have polarised their opinion. They might have looked at that and said, actually, I don't want a bar of either
of you. And in some ways, the winners of those debates weren't on the podiums and may well have been waiting in the wings. The
good
minor
point.
Parties would have been looking at this going, great, this gives us a chance to say, look, the two of Chris's, you can't sort of put a cigarette paper between the two of them.
I absolutely agree. No more prominent for me was, no more obvious was that than when they were asked about what's your big policy. You know, and Chris Hipkins talked about the dental policy for under 30s, right? And when you've got a party like the Greens and the Māori Party who are saying, no, we're going to make this universal, by the way, we've done that from wealth tax, doesn't play. Which surprised me. But it talks about the lack of kind of boldness, the kind of brashness, the kind of, you know, the ability to be able to think really big about a policy. He picks that one.
They all talked about mechanics.
Not GST or food.
Yeah.
Everything was mechanical. Everything was repeating policies that have already been announced in the course of the campaign, except for a couple of missteps, which we'll get to that in a second. But and I know not everybody listens with the same intensity as we do, so there has to be some repetition, right? And reaffirming your policies and making sure everybody knows.
A lot of people coming to this for the first time even, so some voters, right?
Absolutely, I get that. But it was mechanical, and I thought it was mechanical in performance. I thought it was really interesting that Christopher Luxon had the giant ring binder on his podium, and Chris Hipkins had a big stack of papers too, and at which point he actually read from that. But to go back to an earlier point from Julian, it is, where was the I have a dream? And I am sorry, but you have to bring some joy to your citizens, some ambition, some hope, some frickin' rainbows and sunshine, and that was your opportunity to do it, and not just run through the numbers and run through the mechanics.
It's the battle of the middle managers, wasn't it?
Yeah,
that's exactly what it
which
was.
Which is exactly the point that Guy made,
come
is that
on.
There'll be some minor party leaders who are going, the space is open here. We can make a real impression in this minor party leadership.
Yeah, and you're already seeing those two flank parties, at 12% apiece at Acton Greens and New Zealand First nudging in there. So that's well over a quarter of the vote spilling
there'll
that way.
And some shopping there.
And that poll, this poll that we're talking about, the One News Variant poll, only took in a few hours a post leaders debate.
Yep.
So it's going to be interesting to see further wash up from that and whether people shift their previous allegiances. And also, I always find it interesting in a poll where they say, you know, undecided voters, what was it, 12%? 12%. And you think, well, some of you are decided, but you just don't want to say.
Yeah. I want to come back to the minor parties, and I'm conscious of time. So let's just, a couple of specifics from the debate, because we've all got points we want to make. My one was that there was opportunities for Hipkins to really have a go, right? That you're looking for a moment. Not necessarily, doesn't have to always be rainbows and sunshine. Sometimes it just needs to be something that says, I'm here and I mean business and I have a purpose. And there was an opportunity, potentially, in his a comment around Winston Peters.
With all due respect, Chris, Winston Peters and David Seymour would be running circles around you. I mean, Winston Peters brings chaos wherever he goes.
Yep.
I've ruled out working with Winston Peters because stable government does not come from working with Winston Peters.
And then he stopped.
Hmm.
There was not that moment where you go, will you tonight, Mr. Luxon, rule out Mr. Peters? You know, turn to him and actually nail it home. There was a number of opportunities where I thought Hipkins set himself up and then didn't actually swing the ball.
Although he's pretty compromised on that, given it was Winston Peters who put them into government in 2017.
There is that, but, you know.
You can say you've learnt from that experience, right? You can sell it in a certain way.
Yeah.
In the same way, John Key turns around and goes, show me the money.
Yeah.
That was the moment you were looking for.
It was. And look, here's a comparison. I dug out a clip from an earlier debate, because this is one of the ones that really I remember growing up. From the 1993 leaders' debate, you've got Jim Bolger and Mike Moore. And to set the scene, Jim Bolger clearly thinks he's got a great line here, where he's working across the aisle with Jim Anderton on an unemployment initiative, and he thinks he's got Moore in trouble. And watch this.
It was Jim Anderton's suggestion. I said, yes, Jim, we will do that.
Let's talk
I
about
still
jobs.
Want to invite Mike Moore to join us. Why won't you join us, Mike? Why won't you join us? Myself, Jim Anderton, even Winston Peters says he will join.
Well, it's a
why
reasonable question. Let's have an answer, Mr. Moore.
Well, I think it needs a reasonable answer, because I don't trust you, Mr. Bolger.
Boom.
No.
I mean, that was the moment that, for me, Hipkins was looking for a moment like that, and he just couldn't find it.
You're right, and he should have pushed the point further about Winston. The part where I thought he tried to get really forceful was when they were actually talking about health, and then they got into the Māori Health Authority.
Yeah.
And he started having a go at Luxon, and then he got cut off in the end just as he was mid-flow.
Well, we've got that too, so let's just have a look at it.
We are addressing that, and unfortunately, other political parties are choosing to use that for race-baiting
politics.
How
do you respond to that?
Well, that's just not right. I mean, we have a series of public services we make available to all 5.2 million people across New Zealand. You've got to always come through the lens of people's needs, not their ethnicities. That's the deal here
so
in New
Zealand.
So
why should Māori and Pacific people with the same need wait longer than non-Māori and Pacific New Zealanders? Because that's what's happening right now.
Yeah, but Chris, that's not the way to deal with it. You come through the need lens. If someone's waiting longer, then
same need and they're waiting longer. Why is that fair?
You come through the needs lens and you identify the relative priority of people based off length of time they've been on the list, where they've come to, how far they have to go.
The health system.
Yep, and they got cut off there, right? Now, and he, Chris Hickman's is absolutely right. I mean, have a look at rheumatic fever. The cases of rheumatic fever have doubled since last year in the first 6 months of this year, 75% of which are Māori and Pacific Islander, right? Now, this is due to a whole bunch of conditions. This is due to housing in the main, but other things as well, poverty and the like. But this is an ethnic, this is an ethnicity issue, right? The need is the ethnicity. And he could have rammed it home even harder if he wanted to, but he didn't. He pulled back a little bit and he got cut off in the end. This is where Chris Luxon is vulnerable on the need versus ethnicity issue and actually other issues as well. But it's the only part of the debate where I felt Hipkins really tried to have a go. We really got to see him try and bare his teeth.
Yeah, he really pushed in there. But Luxon, and there's a point you made, Guy, that Luxon needed to come in there and not look like the detached kind of what Michael Cullen would call the rich prick, right? He had to come in. And there was a moment which really stood out in this debate where Luxon nailed that really well and tried to humanise himself.
We were newly married. Amanda was in her first job as a teacher. I was in my first job out of university. We stretched ourselves into a house in Nio in Wellington, and then all of a sudden the interest rates went up. And I remember sitting there with our TV on a box and we had one deck chair between us, and that was exactly, it was an incredibly worrying and stressful moment, if I'm honest with you.
Yeah, he's obviously practiced that line, and he probably hasn't done enough on that backstory of coming from relatively modest beginnings. And, you know, he's
famously got 7 properties and many millions now. But it appears that he's earned that himself. He certainly wasn't born with a silver spoon in his mouth, and wanted people to know that. So I think he did capture that. But to Lisa's point earlier, when both the leaders bought houses in their early 20s, certainly not a position that many people are in nowadays.
Yeah. Even if it's a check chair in your own house, that's still pretty good,
so
right?
So on that point, there was a young woman, 23 years old, waitress on Auckland's North Shore, who asked a question of both the leaders about what responsibility wealthier people have to poorer people in Aotearoa, right? I spoke to her on
You
checkpoint.
Did, I listened to that, because she didn't get an answer.
She
really,
didn't
did
get
she,
an answer.
In that debate.
And she was deflated as a 23-year-old voter. That they both just, you know, did the boys hide two-step and went round to a question. And the other thing that sort of ate away at her was the fact that they both had bought these houses when they were really young, her age, and they didn't kind of address that. They didn't address the plight of other people, which we've talked about. Now, the other thing I thought was interesting was, and we had a bit of feedback on this, Christopher Luxon in particular addressed her own personal wealth when her question was actually about the collective, right?
Yes, she'd asked whether people with means had a responsibility to those who don't.
She was asking about the collective, not about her individual financial position. And Christopher Luxon's response to her was to say, help is on the way. Those were his words. Help is on the way.
Saying that
you're going to get an extra $50 a fortnight.
Yeah.
Right? And so that was a misinterpretation. She wasn't asking for herself. She was asking for the broader collective. And also, he referred to her as a medium income earner. So a waitress on, she's on the living wage. Is that a medium income earner now? And in response to her question, also, Christopher Luxon, Chris Hipkins just reiterated no way, no how for a wealth and a capital gains tax. So there you have a 23-year-old voter who's, you know, getting off her backside to inform herself and go to a polling booth, and she can't even get a straight answer.
There was a lot of two-stepping, which ordinarily you would have felt like, look, I'm the first to not try and have a crack at moderators, right? I think it's a bad thing to do. But that's the role, is to keep piercing and poking and going, what's the answer to that question? Here's the question, what's the answer to it? There was a lot of two-stepping. You know, for example, GST or fruit and veg, one question, bit of a two-step, didn't come up again. Which actually Labor would be happy about, to be honest. You know, the tax workings of the National Party, again, the question was posed. There was a couple of questions, moved on. Mm. So there was a lot of two-stepping going on. They're both probably happy that they got away with it.
Yeah.
But when you've got real questions that people are asking you don't answer them, and you two-step away, there's got to be a point at which you bring them back. And that didn't really happen.
The enthusiasm gap we're talking about isn't there in the terms of, as we say, minor parties have now got an opportunity in the last couple of weeks of the campaign potentially to really step up. It was interesting to see how they are trying to move into that space. It's been really hard for the Greens to get coverage. But James Shaw said this at the Queenstown ASB debate last week.
Well, in answer to the previous question, no, I don't think that Nationals numbers add up. And I frankly don't think a lot of people care. They just want a tax cut. Now, one of the great ironies of this is not only is National proposing more taxes than Labor, but the Green Party is actually proposing more income tax cuts than the National Party at this election. And the reason that we are able to do that is because we do want to ask those people who are doing particularly well in this country to chip in a bit more.
Yeah, I thought that was very interesting from James Shaw. And I know we talked about it a few episodes ago on Caucus, but this idea of an independent unit, perhaps in somewhere very credible like Treasury, to cost opposition policies confidentially would be a huge service for New Zealand.
Yeah, it would.
We waste far too much time every election, and we must bamboozle the public with these arguments about fiscal holes. Mm-hmm. And we run around and we spend, oh, I've got you on a fiscal hole. And ever since 2017, with the fiscal hole became the sort of new phrase. And we it's fair enough in the media. We're trying to say, does your policy add up? But, you know, I think we waste a lot of time and confuse the public with this stuff. Mm. And fair enough, I mean, James Shaw may be right. Do the public care? Because they don't know whether it's a fiscal hole or not.
Just a tax cut, right?
Yeah. So yeah. I really think, and you'd need to have absolute secrecy about it, wouldn't you? Because you say National, when opposition was putting a policy up, a tax policy, but Treasury could be
responsible for that. I think it would be a huge service for New Zealand. I know the Greens put it up many years ago, and there've been people who've gone back and forth on it, but I think an independent costing unit would be of huge value.
It's an interesting point. And look, before we wrap, I just want to play this last clip of David Seymour, who is was just after the debate making a very similar point to what we've been making in terms of where the voters might look next.
I would argue from last night's debate, ACT was the real winner because it showed the need for real choice and real change. We do need to turn around the direction of this country with fresh new ideas.
And he went on from that because, I mean, that's the point we're making, right? That people are going to look at those, the leaders' debate, and go, oh, what's everybody else doing then if those guys are the middle managers? But then he went on to say, to talk about what that would look like again with National.
Like I say, I think the circumstances will mean that more is up for grabs than perhaps people realise, because I think Grant Robertson's left worse than... So that is my real answer. But our view is, look, we're not going to negotiate through the media with each other. We have a strong personal relationship. We have clear professional differences. We are going to work through those together if the people choose us. The financial situation New Zealand faces is serious. And I think if we are forming a government, it might go beyond what any particular party wants. It might be about what New Zealand can afford.
So he's backed off his "we'll only give you confidence and not supply." He's not hearing too much about that.
No, he's all in, but he's talking about crisis.
This is the never waste a good crisis moment, isn't it?
It is.
That he's gunning for. And some in the National Party would welcome that because ACT's position might give them cover to do some things that they might not have considered that they would be able to get away with.
Yeah. So it's that point that I think, you know, a lot of the action is going to be around the fringes in the last few weeks, right? Those minor parties are really going to kick in.
Yeah, I'm particularly interested in the James Shaw-David Seymour interaction because when Winston's in the room, he tends to suck up a lot of oxygen. So they're going to be trying to fight for as much of it as they can. But I'm interested in that, in what that interplay is going to look like, because there's going to be a lot of focus on economy and finance.
All right. Thank you, guys. We are out of time, so we'll be back, though, with another episode of Caucus next week. Remember, you can follow us and on any of your podcast apps. You can watch us on YouTube or listen to us on RNZ National.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.